Support for 89.7 NPR News comes from the James at Ohio State, providing access to the most advanced cancer treatments available from a team specialized in treating just one type of cancer, yours. Learn more at cancer.osu.edu/choosethejames.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. YWCA Columbus, a primary provider for emergency housing in Columbus. And they also run the Women's Residency Program, providing women with the opportunity to secure permanent housing. COVID-era dollars have run out and have not been renewed at the federal level. And all of the progress that's been made is facing a growing funding cliff. Central Ohio is facing a $25 million funding shortfall for its emergency shelter system, and those issues have hit the YWCA Columbus, too. This has caused worry within the organization and the surrounding community. The emergency alarm is sounding. That's what YWCA Columbus President and CEO Elizabeth Brown has made clear. And she's here with us today. Welcome to All Sides, Liz.
Thanks, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So, what services were directly and immediately impacted following the fact that you are losing funding? You do not have as much funding as you had in the past years. What's happening at your level?
So our emergency shelter, the YWCA Family Center, which, by the way, next week turns 20 years old, we were the first organization to open our doors for a family-focused emergency shelter. And we provide best-in-class care to families when crisis hits. Mm-hmm. Our emergency shelter services in our community, like communities all over the country, do not rely on federal funding. There's a little bit of federal funding in the mix, but mostly HUD has for a long time viewed local emergency homelessness as a local problem in need of local solutions. So we've been funded through the city and the county and philanthropy along with other shelters like us. That is what's at stake here, because one-time discretionary dollars, our city and our county can't keep up in this current environment. So when you ask what's immediately threatened by the funding shortfall, it is the about 200 people, including children, that we serve every night in YWCA Family Center. And if you sort of step back and look community-wide, the seven nonprofits that serve in the emergency shelter space, we serve close to 10,000 people annually in emergency shelter. So that's really what's at stake when we talk about the funding shortfall.
And the funding shortfall, so you're saying that in the COVID era, maybe everybody had a little bit more grant money to give out and go around. But now everyone is squeezed tight. Everyone's asking for money. Everything seems like it's asking for funding. So is that what you mean, where the funding shortfall is coming from, that everything costs more and the city can't keep up?
Yeah, I would actually step back even further than that. 20 years ago, when we opened our doors, the funding model that we had in our community was sort of split: city, county, philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And at that time, that model fit the problem. But I like to use the analogy of a jacket that I wore 20 years ago, a blazer that looked really good in 2005. And I look in my closet now and I try to put it on and it just doesn't fit what we need in 2025. Mm-hmm. In Columbus, our homelessness problem has grown substantially because we have prospered as a community but haven't been able to keep up with the housing that's needed. And so just in the last year, our homelessness numbers increased by 6 times the rate of overall population. Mm-hmm. So think about that. Over 20 years, the funding model that worked in 2005 just does not work now. And it already wasn't working as COVID hit. My predecessor and those serving in other organizations that I've joined forces with, they were sounding the alarm then too, 2018, 2019. When COVID hit and ARPA dollars were available, it helped to kind of push off the emergency. But now that those dollars are gone, there's really no other, there are no other dollars that are going to come to save us. We have to chart a better local solution.
Well, and whenever you wrote an opinion piece in the Dispatch where it says the emergency alarm is sounding, but it sounds like it's been sounding for years and now more than ever.
Yeah. And now we're saying we need to find a permanent solution that we did know, we used the tools that we had as a community, but we knew they were temporary solutions to use ARPA dollars to plug this growing hole, this huge gap in what it costs to provide shelter for a growing population of homeless individuals and funds available. So we plugged it with one-time money as a community because that's what we had. And now's the time to seek a permanent, dedicated solution to that.
So what's the permanent dedicated solution? Do you get to pick?
Yeah.
No. Is that what you're going around asking for? And what okay, if you could pick, what is a good permanent solution? What do other cities do?
So other cities have a mix of solutions for funding this. Mm-hmm. There's no one-size-fits-all approach. And the really what other communities have in common when they have sought solutions to their homelessness crisis is that the city and the county governments have come together. Mm-hmm. That is a trend across communities who have a problem and then are taking that problem seriously. So today in Columbus, the city and the county have appointed a group of, local business leaders to examine funding needs like this and others, the Funding Review Advisory Committee. Mm-hmm. And to me, as somebody who doesn't make the policy decisions but deeply understands the problem, that's a really good sign because it's demonstrating the collaborative commitment that the city and county are having. Because they're the ones who are going to need to implement a policy that makes sense. There are all kinds of revenue that could be brought into the community. We have solved public problems before. We have, whether that's for the arts, whether that's for tourism, whether that's for our libraries, there are tools in the community that we've said, for this public good, we are going to marshal public resources. And that's what we're asking for.
Hmm. So, I mean, those examples you just gave, they all have like a tax.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So are you advocating maybe for a tax with the funds not going into a general fund, but specifically for the homeless problem?
Yes. Mm-hmm. We are advocating for dedicated funding to the Community Shelter Board, mm-hmm. Which is that unified funding agency that then makes sure our homelessness response is readied across all the shelter provider organizations. And that is that's really the critical piece, that it's dedicated, as you said, because that's what's going to give us the ability to not go through these crises, not have to sound the alarm, but then also to be able to plan and really create the most responsive system. You know, right now, when we are in essentially fear of having to cut beds or cut services every single year, that doesn't allow us to really plan for the best system that serves the most people.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about funding cuts to YWCA Columbus and with CEO and President Liz Brown. But I guess I'm saying that wrong. It's not funding cuts. It's just a lack of dedicated funding.
It's
right?
a lack of dedicated yeah. funding. So every year it's really mm-hmm. on the line. And with ARPA mm-hmm. gone, we know that all of this discretionary money is at risk. Mm-hmm. We're also in a turbulent economic environment. And so city and county budgets, again, they have to balance their budgets every year. Mm-hmm. I used to be on city council. I understand that burden of policymaking. And they don't have a lot of extra money to just continue to do one-time discretionary funding. So we really believe that if we were to find this dedicated solution, that's smarter for everyone. Another point about some kind of tax or fee or added revenue that needs to come into the system is that it's the smartest way to invest our dollars. When people are forced into street homelessness, that is costs the system more. I like to think of our emergency shelters as like the emergency department, the emergency room of our system, right? Mm-hmm. And you need to be able to treat folks who need emergency care, who need crisis care, and then quickly move them through the system into preventive care, right? A dedicated system that can count on its funding from year to year is positioned to do exactly that. These one-time discretionary dollars really over-rely on an emergency department, mm-hmm. Which isn't the smartest way to invest dollars.
Well, speaking of one-time discretionary dollars, the city has a very large bond package that they're putting on the November ballot, $1.9 billion, and there's a dedicated portion of that that is going to the housing crisis. Mm-hmm. It is dedicated to building affordable housing. And so if this passes, there'll be dedicated money that the city's going to borrow, and they're going to try to build more housing faster. That's a part of the problem for you, right? Is you have people in these shelters, and then you have nowhere to put them.
Yes, that is exactly right. So that kind of a dedicated focus on more housing is critical. I want to point out a few numbers when we think about that problem. So first, our affordable housing gap has widened, right, by about 24% since from just 5 to 6 years ago in 2019. So today, for every 100 very low-income people, there are 28 units available at a price they can afford. Mm. That is a math problem that doesn't work. Mm. So bold solutions like the Affordable Housing Bond Package are required to right-size our housing market. And that absolutely affects homelessness. When we opened our doors 20 years ago in 2005, the YWCA Family Center would accept a family into the shelter. And it would take us typically 14, 15 days to rehouse a family. That means matchmake them, essentially, with the right unit, the right landlord that they could afford. You fast forward 10 years later to about 2015, and it had gone up to just under 30 days, right? And that's how long it took to rehouse a family. Mm-hmm. You fast forward another decade later to today, and the average length of time it takes to move a family from entering our doors into a stable lease is 105 days.
Mm. And it's a lot of days to live in a shelter.
It is a lot of days to live in a shelter. That's exactly right, Amy. We are essentially operating a program that we didn't open, right? Mm. What it takes to house families for that length of time. And it's all about housing availability. That number is entirely about housing availability.
Because you're looking for housing, like an apartment that they can fit in, or and you're also probably factoring in what neighborhood they came from or maybe need to be in, that kind of thing.
Yes. I mean, mm-hmm. we meet our families where they are, right? And mm-hmm. we try to find the best possible situation for them and their children. But we also make sure that if there is a lease available at a price that they can afford, that's our first priority. We wish we had more ability to sort of carve out something that serves their perfect need.
Yeah.
But a lot of times it is about finding that stable lease, and it takes that long to do it.
And you said you can house 20 families at a time. Is that right?
50 families. And we are always in overflow status mm-hmm. as well. And so, I mean, we essentially never have any room until somebody leaves. Mm-hmm. And then we are at 100%, really 105% every
single night. Do you have a waiting list? Or does it not work like that?
It doesn't work like that because there's coordinated entry. Mm-hmm. One special thing about our community that I want to point out is that we made the promise, essentially, we meaning people before me, made the promise that no family, no child would go unhoused on the streets for a single night. So when the family system is in overflow, we take some overflow, which means sleeping in hallways, which I got to tell you, I hate, right? Mm-hmm. We hate having to do that to families. But there are a few places in our building where we can do that. And also, same thing at the other family shelter, Van Buren. And then additionally, if there are families that cannot fit in the shelter, they will ensure they are in a motel for the night mm-hmm. or, you know, a few nights until they can get back into the shelter, because we do not want children sleeping on the streets. That's what the funding, this one-time discretionary funding, has been able to hold up. And it's at a breaking point mm-hmm. so that if at the end of the year we can't get, you know, the full funding amount to keep our doors open and the system to keep its doors open, if we can't do that, then we will see children for the first time in our community need to sleep on the street. Along with other unsheltered folks, along with dangerous situations for domestic violence victims. So it is uncomfortable to sound that alarm because it sounds a little like a little bit of hyperbole, but it's very, very real.
Whenever you say that you're a family shelter, because you're talking about domestic violence victims, you're talking about children, do you have men and women, like full families, or is it just women and children?
We have full families. Mm-hmm. So criteria,
or whatever a family looks like.
But, exactly. You know, yeah. The criteria is, what did your family look like when you lost your housing?
Okay.
So if mom and grandma and kids were living together when you got evicted, that's the family we accept. Mm-hmm. If dad and girlfriend and kids were living together, that's the family that we accept. The requirement is there is a dependent in the household, and then whatever that household looked like when they became homeless.
Okay. And you're seeing people losing their housing for a variety of reasons, I'm sure, but is it eviction? They're not able to pay the rent. Mm-hmm. Is it just they were in kind of a temporary place and whoever was letting them stay there said, okay, you're done now?
Yep.
Right.
It's that all of the above. Mm-hmm. The number of experiences, the number of circumstances that lead someone to homelessness is 50, right? Like if we have 50 families in the family center, there are 50 reasons why they are experiencing homelessness. Our eviction numbers are a huge contributor to that. Sometimes there is an unsafe living condition situation where someone might lose their lease, and we don't want them in an unsafe living condition. But then that does, on the back end, present a housing crisis. There are situations where, you know, very quickly a family maybe loses one of their breadwinners, and they just can't keep up with the rent. And of course, that's an eviction for failure to pay. I mean, there are so many reasons why a family ends up in those circumstances.
Coming up, President and CEO of YWCA Columbus, Liz Brown, is staying with us. We're going to continue to talk about the homelessness crisis and also other programs that the YWCA offers. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Support for the homeless community and emergency housing are not the only services YWCA Columbus provides. The list also includes children's programming, job training, advocacy, and more, all of which can be affected by funding cuts. This past summer, the summer youth program was nearly canceled, and currently the after-school program is facing some threats. Still with us, YWCA Columbus President and CEO Elizabeth Brown. Thanks for being here, Liz.
Thanks again for having me.
Let's just touch on briefly what I just said. You had issues with funding related to your summer youth programs and after-school programs. Can you tell me what happened there? You were able to keep them open, right?
Yes. There is a grant program through the federal government called 21st Century Funding. And it's like Title IV-B under, under the federal program. That was stripped of its funding by the Trump administration. And there was a lot of back and forth. We advocated. I know that people on both sides of the aisle advocated to restore that funding. It goes to, and this is nationally, I mean, this really hit youth programs all over the country, including us. And I think, honestly, congressional representatives from both sides of the aisle heard from their communities about that. So the funding was restored. And that's a win. We are thrilled that advocacy worked. We are also remaining vigilant because a couple of our programs, our after-school programs, are exclusively funded through subsidy of that type because we serve solely a low-income group of families. We have other programs that serve all kinds of incomes, and so we then use state publicly funded childcare dollars, but these federal dollars are critically important for programs that exclusively focus on low-income families.
So as it is today, if someone was talking about next summer's youth program, is it going to be okay?
We don't know yet.
Okay.
Yep. So we don't know yet. And we know that our school year program is going to be okay.
Okay. This school year.
Yep. For this school year that we're in, we're confident and we're happy to be serving the same number of families that we served last year and actually growing. And then in our early childhood education work, we are actually opening an additional program in January to help serve more families on the South Side in early childhood education. So even though we don't always know what's to come, we serve the need in our community, and we know there's a real dearth of childcare options, so we continue to try to grow where we can serve.
I wanted to circle back to what we were talking about before with the city's bond package and all of this money that they're putting into a more affordable housing. Because, I mean, eventually that's going to help you, but do you know if any part of the bond package, any line item, because you're looking for dedicated funding, is there a line item in there for the Community Shelter Board that would trickle down to help the YWCA?
So that affordable bond package is for the construction of housing options, and so that would not be for the family center. However, programs like Women's Residency, which are a housing solution to the crisis of homelessness, there's shelter and there's housing, right? And so the Women's Residency program is not that emergency department that I spoke about. Those kinds of solutions, they are expensive to build when you're serving extremely low-income individuals. And the affordable housing bond package, what's so great about it is that there's flexible dollars so that you can braid funding from different sources, including that package, that will help our community open more housing solutions to homelessness. So the answer to that is yes, it will help us, not with our current buildings, because that's not what it's designed to do. It's in the affordable housing bond package is designed to create new opportunities. And those things have a good upstream effect on our work. If more people have housing, that takes the pressure off the family center. And it also means that if we wanted to, as an organization who knows how to serve formerly homeless individuals, if we wanted to open more housing options, more housing solutions, another building, then that policy, that ballot initiative would actually help us do that.
As you advocate for more permanent funding, you know, and we talked about a tax or a fee or something like that, you used to be on city council. I'm sure that everyone and their brother is coming to city council asking for dedicated funding.
Yes.
So are they receptive to you?
They've been extraordinarily receptive. And honestly, we have a few very basic needs as humans: food, water, and shelter. And shelter is not funded as if it is a basic need. It is funded as if it is a luxury. That has been my message and the message of my colleagues like me in the Shelter Providers Network, the seven of us who've banded together to talk about this issue, because we do believe that the urgency and the precarious position of our shelters means it is one of the most important things to solve right away. There has been receptiveness to that message, but of course, nobody's going to make any promises at this juncture.
Tell me more about the Women's Residency Program. So you've mentioned it a couple of times. So it is not the shelter. This is a step beyond the shelter.
Yes, exactly. So the family center is that emergency department, right, when crisis hits. And we serve kids and whoever their guardians are. That is off of sort of Fifth Avenue. And our downtown building, which if you're going up 4th Street and you see the big orange awning and all these banners of women, that's our Women's Residency Program. It is our, I call it the DNA of our organization because it's what we actually opened as. So we're coming up on our 140th anniversary. In 1886, we opened right across the street from where we are now as a 12-room boarding house, serving women and girls who didn't have a place to live. And fun fact about that place, Amy, I have to include this, is that in that facility in 1886, we had on-site childcare.
In
1886, we had on-site childcare.
We can't even get that now.
I know. For the women who worked in the building to serve the women who were homeless.
Women working and having on-site childcare. Who knew? All right, continue.
It's amazing. So this program is very important to us because, like I said, it's our DNA. And we also do incredible work every day. what it now is, all grown up 140 years later, is a much larger building with 91 units. They are studio or one bedroom units that serve women who have been homeless. There is a definition in order to be a part of the federal permanent supportive housing program that you have to have 3 months of chronic homelessness and a certified disability, and then you have access to this program. So we take women who have experienced a high level of trauma, homelessness on the streets, or prolonged periods in shelter. And they also have some kind of a disability, which is sometimes physical, sometimes mental. Mm-hmm. They come in, they have their own lease and their own apartment, as well as the care and support of our service coordinators who are on site. There's three of them who are dedicated to serving the 91 women and helping to connect them with whatever is needed for them to really create long-term stability. Women stay with us at minimum about a year, mm-hmm. but at maximum longer if they're not yet stable. And then they exit to a lease out in the community, taking those tools they learned with us.
Is the goal with the exit that they have a job and can afford another place? Is that...
So sometimes they mm-hmm. Will have employment and can afford that place. They have a voucher that they take with them that is flexible according to their income. And many of our women do have income. Sometimes it's from Social Security is their income. Sometimes mm-hmm. it's from a job. And there's just like varying levels and varying circumstances for them. But the important unifying factor in this program and then all the other PSH providers in our community is that the first thing we do is make sure a woman has a stable home. Mm-hmm. From there, she can work on everything else that is keeping her from long-term stability. And that housing first model, not conditional, but housing first, because again, goes back to that basic need, food, water, and shelter. Without those, we cannot address and work on a long-term plan for stability. So we start with housing, and then we work from there.
And your women's residency program, you said 91. Is that capacity? Is
yep.
that another one of those things where you don't have any extra room?
Correct. Mm-hmm. We have 91 units. They're basically always full, other than, we're turning over about a unit all the time because mm-hmm. somebody's exiting, right? Mm-hmm. And so on any given day, there might be a unit in turnover, but we are full. Our program is in high demand.
The women's residency program is run by the YWCA Columbus. Is it funded solely through your organization?
It is funded through HUD, through Department of Housing and Urban Development.
Okay, so this is a case when federal money is involved. Okay.
Yes, and okay. It's critical.
Okay.
Women's residency is our largest federal exposure. And I use the word exposure on purpose. I think almost three years ago when I started this job, I looked at it as, this is our, federal stability dollars, right? Like we knew they were coming. We understood the program. We understood how HUD ranks programs. And now it does feel like an exposure to have a program that is so reliant on federal dollars because of what this year has been like working with the current administration.
Have you heard about those funds being cut from HUD?
So the president has... through a executive order and memorandum and budget proposals, has basically demonstrated that he is examining a realignment of vouchers. So that's part of what funds the women's residency program, mm-hmm. as well as continuum of care funding, which is what funds the supportive services. Everything touching homelessness, the Trump administration has a completely different view on than what has been longstanding best practice at HUD. So when I talk about housing first, it's very clear in some of the memos and orders issued from the president that he wants to see a reversal of what is ranked as a priority for programs like ours. So, for example, rewarding communities that take actions that criminalize homelessness, rewarding programs that kick women out if they have any kind of a relapse, right? So requiring, sort of proving that you're worthy of housing instead of starting with housing first and then building a stability plan from there.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the YWCA Columbus with President and CEO Elizabeth Brown. And you keep talking about advocating the community, the need for the permanent funding, being out there talking with the city and county about money. You also mentioned private donors. You have an event happening, which is highlighting 20 years of providing emergency shelter. You're calling it the Activists and Agitators event. So that name is pointed, I think.
Yeah.
Tell me about the name.
Yeah, this is actually our eighth year of Activists and Agitators. Mm-hmm. So I was not here when they coined that term for our fall event. But it is an evening event as opposed to our spring event, which is a lunchtime event. Really trying to ensure we're attracting all kinds of different people to our cause and to YWCA Columbus's mission. So Activists and Agitators is about sort of raising the profile of our mission. Our mission is eliminating racism and empowering women. And it's not just a tagline. It's a way, it's a philosophy that underpins all of our work. And so every fall, we highlight that work and we highlight the way that eliminating racism and empowering women actually makes all of our other work possible. This year's event, which is October 8th, tomorrow at CCAD, the Joseph Kanzani Center, is talking about everything that we're talking about here today, Amy, and actually sort of raising some tools that anyone who comes to the event can deploy to get behind our cause, to advocate for permanent funding to emergency shelters, and help to solve the homelessness crisis in our community.
Is it a fundraiser too?
It is a fundraiser as well.
I was just wondering, because we're talking about, you know, wanting the permanent funding from the city and county level, but how about your local philanthropy? How are you doing with people giving organizations, I guess, giving?
Yeah. Local philanthropy is a critical part of the work that we do, and we feel extremely grateful to have dedicated donors to our work. At the end of the day, our philanthropy is only about a fifth of our budget, and we do need government funding as well. So that's why we continue to hold fundraisers to help ensure that we're able to bring that philanthropy in. And then also we advocate at every turn with public funders because it's such a critical part of the mission as well.
And back to the Activists and Agitators event, I was looking at some of the speakers, you're having a panel, and Shannon Isom will be there. Mm-hmm. She is the leader of the Community Shelter Board. She's been on the show talking about some of the same things that you're talking about. Is the Community Shelter Board your partner, your boss? Like, how does that, are they in, yeah, where does that, how does the trickle down go there?
Yeah, I love that question. They are a critical piece of the funding infrastructure in our community. And they were established as HUD-designated unified funding agency, which means they pool HUD resources and then push them into the community before almost any other community in our country. And since then, about 14 or 15 have followed CSB's model here in Columbus. So they are our funder. And what I love about working with CSB is that they don't presume to be our boss, right? They look at themselves as a funder and a partner. And then their strategies to solve homelessness are informed by the real-time experiences and expertise of organizations like ours and the staff who do our work. And then we also look to them to give us guidance on quality assurance. Okay, what does HUD need to see that we deliver on an annual basis to ensure that you, CSB, can pull down as many dollars from HUD as possible? The actual success of our emergency shelters, so we get really good marks from HUD, that helps CSB pull down more dollars into housing, like permanent supportive housing for women's residency. So they are a really strategic piece of the puzzle because they see it all on the continuum. And it works great in Columbus. But again, we need more funding in order for it to really work.
Does the Community Shelter Board give the YWCA any funding, or is it not? Is that?
Yes.
Okay.
So the city and county and the federal government and philanthropy fund CSB. City, county, feds are the predominant part of their funding. Again, philanthropy is critically important, but it's not going to make up the majority of anyone's budget in this work, in this social services work. So they fund CSB, and then CSB uses those dollars to push out to our programs. HUD dollars are for specific purposes, so they can't take HUD dollars that are intended for women's residency and send them to Family Center instead, right? But they are able to be as efficient with those use of dollars as possible because they're sort of one clearinghouse for them.
Okay. Coming up, Liz Brown is staying with us, and we're going to be joined by a former resident of the YWCA program, and she's going to tell us her story. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Sources and methods, the crown jewels of the intelligence community. Shorthand for how do we know what's real? Who told us? If you have those answers, you're on the inside, and NPR wants to bring you there. From the Pentagon to the State Department to spy agencies, listen to understand what's really happening and what it means for you. Sources and Methods, the new national security podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. There's no debate that emergency housing provides support for the homeless, but in most cases, it's not a permanent solution. The YWCA has programs aimed to answer the question of what's next. The program provides stable housing and builds women up to the point where they can secure permanent housing. Taylor Perdue Zamora, a former resident of the YWCA, is here to share her success story with us today. Welcome to All Sides, Taylor.
Hello.
So, and still with us is Elizabeth Brown, YWCA Columbus President and CEO. Thanks for being here, Liz.
Thank you.
So, Taylor, can you tell us what brought you to YWCA Columbus?
Just to tell my experience on how it went in the YWCA shelter.
Yeah, so tell me about what led you to having to be at the shelter.
I had a house fire, and that's what led me there. I didn't know where else to go, so.
Yeah. And Liz, you were saying earlier that if you have 50 different women in a program, there's 50 different reasons that led them there. So, like, we listed off a couple, but house fire wasn't one that I thought of. So
that's right.
That can
that's
be. Right. Okay. So you didn't have a place to live. You were looking for shelter. Can you tell me about it? Was it you? You have kids, right?
Yes.
Was it you and your kids looking for shelter or just you?
Just me and my kids.
Okay. And how many kids? What are their ages?
I have four kids. I have a soon-to-be 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, a 2-year-old, and a 1-year-old.
Okay. So when you entered the program with the YWCA, you went to the family center, I'm assuming. What was that like for you and your family?
Scary at first. It was terrifying for me. I never experienced it. So
did it get less terrifying the more you were there?
It did.
Tell me about that. Did you feel a sense of community?
I did. There were a lot of people that helped me during the process, and it was good.
And how long were you with the family center? Do you know?
I was there about maybe almost 9 months.
9 months? Yeah. Okay. So, Liz, that's what you were talking about, where you used to be able to move people into permanent housing much quicker than that. But was finding a place for you because just it took time?
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? What were they looking for? What were they trying to find for you? A place that fits you and four kids, right?
Yeah. Okay. Definitely a place for me and my four kids. Yeah. Just somewhere that where it was just like somewhere I wanted to call home. Mm-hmm. Somewhere safe, definitely. And
do you feel that now? Do you have that
definitely,
now?
Definitely, yes.
Okay, so where you are now, you feel safe, you feel that it's home?
Absolutely.
How do your kids feel there?
They are adjusting.
Yeah.
It's a big change.
Tell me about your kids in the family center. Were they able to, because I know that there's childcare services, there's different programs, were they able to kind of like feel safe and happy and at home there?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What are some things that they did there that they liked?
They did like cool activities. They always had like an event like every month, depending on what like the month was. Like, for example, this month is Halloween. So like they would do like cool little things every month. for the kids on the weekends because the kids didn't have school. So they would have like crafts and like they would do like stuff outside, barbecues, all types of stuff for them.
Yeah, Liz, tell me more about making people feel at home, even though it is technically a shelter.
Yeah. We know that that's challenging because mm-hmm. suddenly you're at home with 50 other families, and that is not the experience that anyone wants to be in. We wish that no one had to be there at all. And so when they are at the family center, our goal is to make the experience as welcoming as possible for parents, of course. But I really like what you said about your kids, Taylor, because we know parents are navigating a lot of stress. And if we can at least make things very welcoming for their children, that's going to take a piece of stress away. Our Safe and Sound Child Care Center, which I know probably your youngest children were in, as well as maybe your older ones in the aftercare program, right? So we have all day, we're open as an early childhood education center, and then we have aftercare for school-aged kids when they get off the bus. And it's a 5-star, high-quality early childhood education center. One of the key pieces of that center is that when a family enters, we have room for them in the program. We aim to have a zero waitlist situation. Taylor, I don't know what your did you have access right away when you got to the family center?
Okay.
So that is a huge success. to have 4 children, and you know, you were coming into an environment that you said you were terrified of. We want to have that safe place for the kids right away. And actually running an operation and making sure you always have zero wait list is way easier said than done. So our team does incredible work there to balance classroom ratios and staff availability and all the things that make a zero wait list happen.
Yeah, I can imagine. So your older kids were probably in school during the day, but the younger ones, if you needed to go to work, you had a place for them to feel be safe and taken care of, right?
Yes.
So, Taylor, you now work at the Kids Thrive as a behavioral health technician.
Yes.
Can you tell me what Kids Thrive is?
Kids Thrive is a behavioral health learning center. It is a it's basically for kids that have had been kicked out of like schools or like, you know, their daycares due to behavioral problems. We do like one-on-one sessions. There's therapy there to help them just get them back into school and help their behavioral.
Do you like your job?
I love it. Good. I love the kids.
And so now that you've moved out of the YWCA center, are you able to find childcare and everything and like to, so you can keep your job and everything?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Liz, how common is it for the people who come to the YWCA? How common is it for people to have young children, multiple young children versus women being by themselves? Is there like numbers you can put on that?
So at the family center, there are always children in every family. And if you look at, I'm not recalling our age spread offhand, the data offhand, I don't have it in front of me. But if you look at the breakdown, sort of the plurality of kids are in that young sort of toddler to early elementary schooler age. Mm-hmm. That's where you're going to find the highest concentration of kids. That is sort of across all 50 families. And obviously the data changes, you know, throughout the year, but that's commonly what you find. It's also very, very common that families are working while they're in crisis, right? Sometimes unemployment might be what leads to a situation of being unhoused, but oftentimes it's just the fact that housing is expensive or a crisis like Taylor talked about. So close to 40% of the families who are in the family center are actually getting up and going to work every day, not just there to look for employment, but have it when they enter our door.
And is that the case for you?
Yeah.
You had your job. It's just that you had this house fire and you were suddenly without a place to stay, right?
Yeah.
So did you use any of the other wraparound services that YWCA offered besides the childcare? Did you, you know, I don't know, having a house fire would be traumatic. Did you go to counseling or did you?
Yes, I did. Yeah. I took advantage of everything that they offered.
Mm-hmm. Liz, what kind of counseling situation do you have? I'm sure that everyone there has had some sort of trauma. I mean, it's, you know, there's there's different ways to need to there's different reasons to need to talk to someone.
Absolutely. So we rely on a lot of partnerships with other community providers, and we try to make it easy on people to have those services come on site, whether that's Eastway for mental health or even sort of medical care, where we have you know, a mobile clinic come and pull up and provide that opportunity for our families. In terms of our staff, the most important staff role is what is called a family advocate, and they're essentially your housing liaison. Mm-hmm. When a family enters, they are going to be the ones that you, of course, talk about more than housing because you have other needs, but we want our staff principally focused on making that housing match. Taylor described how having four kids, there weren't a lot of leases, right, that really matched what your family needed. I will say to any developers or policymakers who are listening today, please, with that affordable bond package money that's coming, build more 3- and 4-bedroom houses. Please build more units that accommodate families. It is so easy to build a unit and say that it's
just build a bunch of 1-bedrooms.
Yep. And yeah. Say, oh, we're hitting the low income threshold. You know, we're building affordable, but it only is affordable if you're a single person. And that's not the reality in Columbus.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the YWCA Columbus programs with President and CEO Liz Brown and former resident Taylor Perdue Zamora. So, Taylor, did you end up are you in an apartment or a condo? Do you have multiple bedrooms, or are you kind of squeezed in?
I do have multiple bedrooms. I'm in a duplex. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So is that what you and whoever was helping you to look for the secure housing, look for a lease, is that what they were looking for you? They were trying to find you at least a 3-bedroom.
Yes. Yeah, definitely with 4 kids, I need more than 1-bedroom. So, yeah.
Like after you'd been there for 30 or 60 days, were they like, do you want a 1? Like, did they offer you like a smaller place and you decided
like
to wait?
2-bedroom. Mm-hmm. I definitely let them know though, like no 1-bedroom was not going to work. Mm-hmm. Not with 4 kids.
And so in addition to working right now, are you also going to school? Is that right?
I am currently going back to school, yes.
What are your future plans?
To become a nurse.
Okay, great. Yeah. Can you tell me what it was like, your journey with the YWCA to where you are now? I mean, obviously, if you could go back in time, you know, you would not want to have a house fire, right? But tell me about, like, making the best of a bad situation, I guess.
Staying positive, keeping your head up, and always saying, like, good things. Like, I motivate myself with, like, positive affirmations. So I also made a vision board, and I put it on my wall in my room when I was at the shelter, and I would always look at it as a motivation of I'm gonna get what I want and go for it. I've always been like a positive person too, to like motivate others, and just even if I'm just because I'm going through a tough situation doesn't mean I have to be mean or nasty to people. Like, you can encourage everybody else. Like, I encouraged a lot of residents.
Did you make some lifelong friends? Did you make some good connections
there?
I
made a few. Yeah.
Yeah. Tell me about having 4 children in the YWCA shelter, because staying positive and I'm sure you were in kind of a tight space. How did that go?
I had my days. They were a little overwhelming, but there was not a day that I didn't get through it.
Yeah. And can you tell me about like what your, because you have different types of rooms there. Mm-hmm. Did you have all the kids with you in the same room at the shelter?
Mm-hmm. So. Yes.
So you had to deal with like, you know, a crib and a cot and that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Did the kids stay positive or?
Yeah. I always uplifted them to like, just keep your head up. It's not forever. This mm-hmm. is just temporary.
Yeah. How do you, Liz, can you talk about that idea of it's just temporary, keeping your head up, staying positive, having a vision board? How important is that in a place like the YWCA?
That's so important. And thank you, Taylor, for talking about your experience mm-hmm. and how you got through it. It takes an incredible amount of courage and grit and vision. Mm-hmm. So you made that a reality by actually decorating your room accordingly. That kind of that has to underpin the work that we do at the Family Center. It's one of the reasons that Safe and Sound is so important, because it is part of that fabric of the Family Center that also helps kids stay positive. Mm-hmm. I know as a mother, it's a lot easier to stay positive myself when my kids are positive. It's a lot harder when they're not. And it's a huge, huge focus of what we do. And I just, hearing Taylor's story, it is a reminder that somebody, a mother who has a few kids and a job, should not be in a situation where she has to be in a shelter for 9 months in order to find housing that works for her. Just Taylor's story in and of itself, I want you to know, should be a call to our community to do better.
Yeah, and I can imagine with four kids, you know, after you had the fire, you can lean on family or friends, but like the reality of having you and four kids move into someone else's house is probably not a long-term solution. Is that what you were faced with?
Yeah.
So we only have about a minute left, but how do you feel now that you've come out on the other side and you have the permanent housing and your kids are where you want them to be? How are you feeling now?
I'm feeling good. I feel like I like that I went through that experience. It taught me a lot about myself, and it taught me a lot about others. And it was a good experience for me.
Liz, do you see a lot of resilience in your line of work?
Absolutely, every day. I think that is very obvious in this conversation here today, mm-hmm. and I'm so appreciative when people are willing to tell their story. I see resilience from our staff as well as our residents, I want to say.
Well, I want to thank you both for joining me today. We've been talking with Taylor Perdue Zamora. Taylor, thank you so much for coming on and telling us your story.
Thank you for having me.
And we've also been talking with YWCA Columbus President and CEO Liz Brown. Liz, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Amy.
And this has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.